At this hour, a news conference with the State Attorney General is getting underway. The office is to release part of its probe into the Maui wildfires. It's to cover the timeline in response to the disaster, which killed 100 people. Another phase of its probe into the cause of the fire is to be released later this year. Hawaiian Electric could face close to $5 billion in potential liabilities from the lawsuits filed over the Maui wildfires. That is according to Capstone, a consulting firm that studies utilities under stress for its investor clients. The conversation's Maddie Bender talked to Capstone analysts Elisa Liu and Josh Price this morning as lawmakers are preparing to make a decision on legislation that could involve the Public Utilities Commission and impact HECO's bottom line.
At Capstone, we're a consulting firm that works primarily for institutional investors and some corporates. And a big part of our product is covering utilities that are under stress, whether that was Pacific Gas and Electric in the situation in California, First Energy in Ohio. Anytime there's a market dislocation or a significant liability facing a publicly traded stock, Capstone will endeavor to provide a view and, you know, dig into the information as much as possible to ensure that our clients are best informed on the situation at hand. We've been expecting the Attorney General's report for some time now. It was nice to get clarity a few months ago in testimony that, you know, April 17th is the date, so later today.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in terms of changing the liability picture, we're not expecting the Attorney General report to outline the causation or the origin of the fire or really assign blame on a technical basis. Our understanding is the report will mostly outline the county's response, so how the fire department, how the police department responded, any other kind of structural or infrastructure issues in the response. Nothing really technical on how the fire actually started or anything that could refute or dispel Hawaiian Electric's theory that there was a second fire that led to the disastrous destruction in Lahaina. And so we're not really expecting, said another way, the report to clarify or change the picture from a liability standpoint. What we are looking for, we heard some hints about this yesterday during the Maui Fire Department's press conference, is the report from and the analysis from the Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, ATF Bureau that will actually get into the details on fire origin and causation. That will be critical for, we think, the litigation and liability picture. So right now, I think most people assume, and HECO admitted, that its infrastructure and equipment started the first fire. But there's this uncertainty around whether it smoldered, whether it was fully extinguished, whether there was a second fire unrelated to that equipment. And I think that lingering uncertainty is kind of impacting the market and having an impact on the litigation. Now, one of the key things we saw yesterday in some of the headlines around the Attorney General report that should come out today was a finding that the Maui Fire Department and Police Department acted prudently and weren't to be at fault or blame here. I do think in the litigation where, you know, Maui County is the defendant alongside HECO and some other entities, like anything that deflects blame away from Maui County, in theory, should be negative for HE when thinking about the share of liability or ultimate responsibility in a settlement or any verdicts that Hawaiian Electric could face. But I don't think there's going to be anything specifically that bolsters or hinders HE's argument around the second fire in this Attorney General's report, but anything that moves blame away from other defendants in the litigation, in theory, should be negative for Hawaiian Electric.
Could you give a lay of the land, at least the way you kind of laid it out to your clients in January, about the various measures making their way through the House and Senate and what that might mean for HECO's solvency and financial situation?
I think there are two key bills that really impact Hawaiian Electric at this point that are still moving forward in the legislature. One is SB 2922, which is the securitization bill, and the other is HB 2700 and SB 3344, the companion bills that establish the Hawaii Wildfire Relief Fund. So at a high level, the securitization bill would allow Hawaiian Electric to securitize costs going forward associated with future wildfire protection plans that they file in front of the PUC. The bill language has been significantly amended since its initial proposal, and that initial proposal would have allowed them to also securitize costs associated with the August Maui fires and all future catastrophic wildfires. That bill language is still being debated, and we don't have the final version of the bill yet. But the current version of the bill really focuses on those forward-looking wildfire protection plan costs. And then the other bill that's still moving forward is the Hawaii Wildfire Relief Fund. And that would create an insurance fund that utilities and other entities, including the state, could contribute to that would provide compensation for property damage resulting from future catastrophic wildfires. I would say HECO's future is really reliant on the passage of these bills. HECO's credit rating right now has been downgraded by multiple rating agencies to junk status, which has significantly limited their access to capital. And even outside of addressing liabilities associated with the Maui fires, HECO will need to make significant investments in wildfire mitigation and prevention projects going forward, which would be extremely difficult without securitization financing at this point. So in the scenario where you don't have that happen, you would likely see HECO run out of financing options pretty quickly. And similarly with the Hawaii Wildfire Relief Fund, that would provide a significant amount of insurance protection for the utility going forward. Right now, they potentially face billions in liabilities from the Maui fires. So having that fund that they're able to contribute to in the future, especially to resolve property damage claims, would provide them with significant insurance in the going forward picture, especially given the rising risk of wildfires in the state.
Has your outlook on the likelihood of either of these measures being passed, has that changed at all since January?
I would say definitely on the securitization bill. So the bill, SB 2922, originated in the Senate, and it was initially called the Catastrophic Wildfire Securitization Act. And that bill had language in it that noted the tough spot that HECO is in financially right now, and it proposed to allow HECO to securitize costs associated with the August wildfires. And that version of the bill was essentially viewed by lawmakers and citizens as a bailout bill for HECO. But now that the bill has been significantly amended, especially after it was transferred over to the House, now it really has go-forward language that focuses on those wildfire protection plan costs and focuses on utility wildfire prevention efforts going forward for future wildfires. And so that has significantly increased the likelihood that especially the House lawmakers, which have been reluctant to really look at any bill that is viewed as a bailout bill for HE, that's really increased the likelihood that the House would be willing to pass this.
At the same time, many people have called it almost a HECO bailout bill. So in some ways, I'm not sure that it's been able to escape its perception as that, even though, as you're saying, the language has been significantly amended.
I do think you're definitely right on that front, especially given the context that the bill was initially introduced in. But given that they might clean up some of the language as they are moving forward with conference committees now, they may make it more explicitly clear in the bill that it will only cover go-forward costs for HECO and will only really focus on those wildfire protection plan costs rather than anything associated with Maui, which would definitely help the public perception of the bill.
Is there a world in which any of these reports influence how lawmakers end up voting on some of these wildfire measures?
I would say the big thing on lawmakers' mind is a thorough investigation into the fire causation. We saw some key senators ask the PUC to conduct their own investigation and questioned why they haven't already done this. Again, there's still some uncertainty around whether there was a second fire, what really caused all this destruction. So once there's certainty on that, I think it will make it more difficult for the legislature to do anything that could be viewed as favorable for Hawaiian Electric, or anything viewed as a bailout. I mean, it already is pretty difficult, as you've seen in some of the House testimony and hearings in particular. But once the ink is dried on that causation, I think it'll be even more difficult for the legislature to pass anything that's viewed as overly favorable for the company.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we have heard that ETF in the Maui Fire Department could release it as early as this month. So with the session ending in early May, there could be some opportunity for this to impact the negotiations, but you know, something we're certainly keeping our eyes out for.
And what's the outlook if the session ends and there are no wildfire measures passed?
I think if neither of these bills pass this session, it'll be really important to see how the litigation plays out for the rest of the year. The judge in the Maui Circuit Court has recently held a status hearing and discussed potential settlement and mediation processes going forward. And so once the picture of the full liabilities from Maui is better understood, then it could definitely inform conversations for next legislative session going forward. And HE might be able to provide more clarity to lawmakers that they weren't able to provide this session on how they plan to address existing liabilities and move forward at the company.
What are you going to be watching over the next?
So on the legislative side of things, one of the key dates to watch for is going to be April 25th. And that's the date by which lawmakers need to submit bills for final reading. So for both of the bills, the securitization bill and the Hawaii Wildfire Relief Fund that are currently being evaluated in conference committees, the House and the Senate will need to agree upon a final version to submit for final readings by that date. And so that's when we'll get more clarity over the final language in these bills. And then we'll expect to see final votes on those bills between that April 25th date and when the session ends on May 3rd. And then, as mentioned, the AG's report, which is coming later today, we'll look at that to see whether it helps absolve any of the other defendants' liabilities in the litigation processes going forward. And also, once we get the Maui Fire Department report in conjunction with ATF and get a more clear causation determination there, that'll be a significant catalyst as well.
Well, thank you, Josh and Elisa, for coming on. I really appreciate the both of you. I've found this really informative. So thank you again for this.
Yeah, thanks so much, Maddie. It was great to talk to you.
That was Capstone Energy Team Director Josh Price and analyst Elisa Liu speaking with The Conversation's Maddie Bender. We will continue to track the reports and legislative measures relating to the wildfires. You can read our coverage online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from the University of Hawaii, presenting Reimagining Homelands, a retelling of ancestral memories through Japanese and Okinawan music and dance, April 20th and 21st at Leeward Theater.
You know, there's something new at Honolulu's airport. Driverless shuttle service got underway this morning. It is a first for the Department of Transportation, and it's also the first airport use for the vendor Beep. It's the latest effort to electrify our vehicles to meet our statewide green goals. The year-and-a-half test run will include four autonomous vans to shuttle less than a dozen passengers at a time with roll-on luggage. Seatbelts are recommended and no standing allowed for good reason. Here's Beep Chief Revenue Officer Toby McGraw.
So we've operated in about a dozen sites across the country historically. We've done cities like Atlanta, where we currently run in Peachtree Corners. We run at Cumberland Gap in CCID. We do work in Orlando. We've previously done work in Miami and Tampa. We've also operated in Charlotte, North Carolina. We have three different sites in Northern California and the Bay Area in Walnut Creek, down to the San Jose, Santa Clara region. And we've even done things like operating in national parks like Yellowstone National Park previously. So we've done a bunch of different use cases over the years.
And so this will be the first test at an airport though?
That's correct. This is the first time. We had a couple other airport partners that were really interested in moving forward in Honolulu and the state of Hawaii just really being on the cutting edge. We're the first to really jump in. And so we'll have four of these vehicles running around from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. at night.
And I understand you'll be using geofencing to help kind of control and manage the flow of these vehicles.
Yeah, that's right. And so our belief is that when you're testing autonomous vehicles, you want to start in really controlled environments to start. And so these geofenced areas, the vehicles are not operating around. And so this isn't like an anywhere-to-anywhere program. It's a robot that's going to go pick up people. This is very much within these tight geofenced zones. We've gone through and done high-definition mapping of this entire route. So as you get on it later, you'll be able to like feel that self-driving experience. Now, with these current generation shuttles and with this pilot program, we actually have safety attendants that are going to be on board the vehicle. These safety attendants will act as ambassadors to be able to tell passengers about what to expect, make sure that we're enforcing all the safety things that are required. And then there are also an additional set of eyes just to make sure that in these mixed case of traffic flow, the vehicles are operating safely in and around all the other things. You know, you see out here today, there's different places where you have cars on the side of the road. There have been construction crews and different things like that. These vehicles will, since that, make very hard stops if necessary. So the safety teams are really on board to make sure they're communicating all the things that are happening on route.
Okay, and then I guess people might ask, okay, are these things going to be then on the tarmac? Are they going to be, you know, bumping into the guys that take the luggage off the plane, kind of traffic?
Yeah, so none of this is going to be actually on the tarmac itself. It's all the existing loop that the WikiWiki shuttle has run on before, just different parts of that.
And then as far as charging them?
Yeah, so these have about a 4-hour runtime. So we were overlapping different times based upon the demand of the day. But roughly 4 hours on route. They take about 2 hours then to go from 20% to 80%, which is really that ideal charging window.
Any issues with accidents in some of the other locations where you run these?
Yeah, there have been, you know, a couple of small collisions, never an injury, fortunately. Just different times in mixed case situations where you've seen, you know, some of this interaction. You know, the nice thing about these are low speed shuttles, so they're programmed on the WikiWiki routes to only go 10 miles an hour. So these are all lower speeds, more controlled environments. And so in the cases where we've had issues in the past, it's been human error on the part of the other vehicles. For instance, we're going through a four-way stop and then someone blows right through the stop sign. So things that you'll see in a human-to-human interaction quite frequently, we believe that with this platform, it's actually been an even safer experience because These things will sense obstacles and stop very, very quickly.
And then you've got seats, but is there enough room for people to stand as well?
So on these specific vehicles themselves, it's going to be sitting only. There will be no standing riders. In future versions of the vehicle, which are a little bit larger form factors, we would envision some standing as well as seating as well. And so with these, you have a capacity of about 10 passengers, excuse me. And the future versions with standing, it might get up to 15.
Just roll it out slowly, step by step, baby steps.
You're right. That's exactly right.
And you may not know that the smart shuttles join a fleet of other electric vehicles. We noticed on a recent tour of the airport that we took with U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg that Tesla Model 3 sedans were quietly zipping around on the tarmac. We were told that there were 56 in use for the State Transportation Department on Oahu and the neighbor islands. We talked to State Transportation Director Ed Sniffen about why the state decided to purchase Teslas right after the short break.
Support for HPR comes from Mobi, a Hawaii wireless company serving the island since 2005, committed to providing personal service to each customer, featuring a locally based customer care team. Learn more at mobi.com.
Let's get back to our story about the increased use of electric vehicles at Honolulu's airport. In addition to the driverless shuttle service that debuted today, the State Transportation Department has bought 56 Tesla Model 3s and put them in service across the islands. Here's Transportation Director Ed Sniffen talking about the decision to step out and take the lead in this area of green fleets.
Overall, we started to look at how we can make sure that we can run our operations a lot cleaner and a lot more efficiently. And these vehicles do both of those, ensuring that we can get to our electric conversion faster, but also looking at how we manage our airport resources to ensure that we're as efficient as possible for all the public.
So we roll these out, see how they go, maybe get bigger ones?
Yep. So right now, this is an 18-month contract that allows us to check it out, see what we're trying to do. And this kind of is on the heels of our trial that we're doing at UH Manoa with our autonomous vehicle there. We're trying this out, see if it fits our airport operations. If it does, we'll expand to make sure that we build out our efficiency and build out our electric fleet.
And so this isn't the first EV vehicle that you have. I know that you folks did roll out the Teslas a while ago. How's that going?
Yeah, we have a bunch of Teslas and we have a bunch of Ford Lightnings on the system to ensure that we start replacing our sedans, but also some of our mid-duty trucks that we need on the system. They're going really well. The concerns that our staff had about electric vehicles, the need for the charge, the potential for upset in operations. Once we started running the vehicles, all of those concerns went away. We're able to make sure that we keep the charges up and keep the vehicles in operation with our normal sequencing. So we're doing well with our electric conversion, and we're helping other state agencies and county agencies do the same.
And you purchase these vehicles under that same system?
Yes. So these vehicles, we're purchasing the service of the vehicle. We're not buying the vehicle itself. The great thing about that is our partner, Sustainability Partners, they own the vehicles. They're responsible for maintaining them to ensure that they're in good working order. So for the state, and I'll just say up front, the state is not the best at maintaining our equipment. So we have a partner that does it with us to ensure that we have vehicles that people want to ride and people want to drive. It's the best case for everybody.
So with the Teslas, I understand that they were low bid.
So when we got the prices from sustainability partners, we got it for three different vehicles: Teslas, Nissan Leafs, and Chevy Bolts. And the price that we got for the Tesla was the lowest of all. And it was for several reasons. Because our sustainability partner's partner is responsible for the maintenance and the resale of the vehicle at the end of the contract, they take all of that into consideration. So although the Tesla upsell price was higher than the Nissan Leaf and the Chevy Bolt, its maintenance was far superior, its charging stations far superior, and its resale value way better. So they took that all into consideration to give us the rate that's better than the other two.
So as far as expansion plans, is there something else besides the Mickey beeps?
Well, at this time, we're looking at just these two for now. We wanted to make sure we kept our scale a little small, ran it to see what's necessary, see what kind of hiccups we see, and then we expand from there. Some of the big things we can see from adjusting to an autonomous vehicle in our airport with our Wiki buses, you'll see that we have turnaround points that take up a lot of space on the airport. If we can run these that are bi-directional, that get rid of the need for those turnaround points, those are now spaces we can enclose, turn into terminal space, and capture the value of.
The geofencing, I understand that this is going to be using that. Are you aware, have we used this before?
We have not used the geofencing before, but our partners are really good at it. So I think they can speak a lot more to the geofencing and what the technologies entail.
Anything else you want to add just about, you know, as we go green and all the improvements that you folks are doing to electrify our fleet at this point?
We are trying to be leaders in the industry for Hawaii to ensure that we go greener faster, efficiently, so to make sure we can keep the costs down, and also make sure that we take care of all the resources that we have here. So I would encourage everyone, when you come to the airport, jump on a Mickey shuttle, test it out, try and see what it looks like, because we can see that there's a lot of opportunities in Hawaii for these types of services in different areas.
Neighbor islands.
Absolutely, neighbor islands, downtown, connections between rail stops to destinations. There's a lot of different last mile pieces that technology like this could handle.
That was State Transportation Director Ed Sniffen. And in addition to the driverless shuttles and the Tesla utility fleet, the DOT is also testing out electric street sweepers. They're in use in Kona and Hilo. DOT expects to add about 150 more Teslas and electric vehicles later this year. Hawaii isn't the only state to turn to Teslas. Caltrans recently made the largest single order for the EVs to date. But getting back to the driverless shuttles, we can tell you that Miki apparently means agile in Hawaiian. To be honest, our test ride yesterday was not that smooth, more herky-jerky. But the next time you're at the airport and you get the chance, jump on the Miki vans, you be the judge. DOT wants your feedback.
Support for HPR comes from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra's Beethoven Fest. Rapa Nui pianist Mahani Te Ave performs Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 1. Dane Lam conducts April 21st at Hawaii Theater. MyHSO.org.
We now switch gears to talk about taking flight. For this week's Manu Minute, University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart shares the sound of the apapane, the crimson honeycreeper. It's the only one of its species that can be found on all the major Hawaiian islands.
The apapane is a direct descendant of a flock of finches that somehow flew from Asia over nearly 3,000 miles of open ocean and landed in the Hawaiian Islands more than 5 million years ago. It's one of over 55 species of birds, now known as the Hawaiian honeycreepers, that evolved from that original group. And nowadays, it's the only one left whose song can still be commonly heard on all the main Hawaiian islands, especially if you're in a forest where the ohia lehua are blooming, as their curved bills and brush-like tongues are perfectly adapted to forage on the nectar of these flowers. Even though Apapane are a brilliant bright red in color, they're often more easily detected by their beautiful song, which has recently been found to vary between the islands and even between different forest patches or kipuka on the same island. For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Patrick Hart from the Department of Biology at the University of Hawaii at Hilo.
Support for Manu Minute comes from the Hawaii Audubon Society, working to protect Hawaii's native wildlife through programs and projects such as its Kolea Count. Learn more about programs and volunteering at hiaudubon.org.
Jonah Fuentes is to graduate from Kapolei High School next month. For his senior project, he chose to raise awareness of the dangers of drunk driving. He partnered with Mad Hawaii for a recent sign-waving event in Ho'opili. It was aimed at educating the public and getting motorists to change their behavior. The conversations, Russell Subiano sat down with Fuentes in our studio earlier this month and discovered this was a very personal issue.
Can you tell us about your project?
Well, for my school, not only was it a requirement for me to graduate, but it was something where we were kind of forced to go into our community and really get a real taste of what it's like to be out in the real world. So for me, choosing a list of topics, you know, I didn't want to do it for just the grade. I wanted to do something where it was personal to me and that I had a passion for, and where if I put 100% of my interest and effort into it, I'll get a return for it. So I think that was very important for me.
You mentioned that you wanted to choose a topic that was important to you. Do you have a friend or a family member or somebody that you know that's been impacted by driving under the influence?
Yeah, I think that's why I made it personal for me. I had an older brother that he was under the influence, and that's what made really, like, this one stuck with me and really made me want to do it.
How did that impact you? How did that make you more passionate about bringing this awareness to the community?
Well, for me, it was personal because, you know, it was like a disappointment to the family. It was also like a financial burden with all the fees and the lawyers and the classes. But it just also made me really think, like, for drunk driving, anyone can do it. It's preventable, 100% preventable. It's just like he could have hurt someone or hurt himself and could have possibly went to prison for a long time. So it made me really think about how many more people are doing it other than just my older brother and just people around the island.
I saw some of the numbers for teenagers driving drunk or driving under the influence. I saw that car crashes are the leading cause of death for teenagers. 1 in 4 crashes with teens involve an underage driver. How prevalent is driving under the influence among people your age?
I would say that one's tough because, you know, we're not supposed to be drinking and driving.
Yeah.
But I feel like more today with our generation, they're doing that. And I think it's like more of a who you surround yourself with. So if you surround yourself with people that are doing drugs and drinking and driving, I think you're more likely to do it. But if you surround yourselves with people where they're just trying to be better for themselves, make a career out of themselves, I think that's where it won't happen. So I really think it's where you surround yourself and the people that you surround yourself with.
Aside from the people that you surround yourself with, and I think that's important because I think the saying is that you are a reflection of the 5 people that you hang around with most. So aside from changing the people that you spend the most time with, what do you think it will take to really reach students and parents to remind them or help them realize the consequences of drunk driving?
Well, for drunk driving, I would say the best possible outcome for them would be getting pulled over and dealing with all the fines. And what people really don't think about is if you were to hurt yourself or hurt somebody else, now not only do you have the financial burden, but also you're going to prison for that. And now you have to deal with the guilt that you've taken away someone else's life,
yeah,
someone's loved one, or even the guilt of you passing away. And then now your family has the burden of that too.
Yeah. What do you think in terms of, say, enacting laws or what communities can do as a whole to maybe intervene in certain situations. Do you think there are also parts of the solution that come from outside of the person or their immediate people that they hang out with?
The community, I think that's an important way to do it. Just being out there and just advocating and putting out a word. Just like I'm pretty sure you saw it where we were having the sign wavings. Also went to the Capitol building where they had a bill that we're trying to pass where it was from 0.8 to 0.5 for a BAC level. So I think just really working on it and just getting as many people to rally up and call for a change is very important.
And you mentioned the sign waving that you did last month. What do you think the impact was on the community as they drove by or the participants as they were waving the signs?
Well, first off, I couldn't have done it without my parents. So it was very time consuming because it was a lot of emails, a lot of planning. And it was just the whole community get up and just being able to have my block there help me, support me. For me, just waving those signs, it was good because not only does it raise awareness and I'm getting all the publicity, but it also goes out and reaches a lot of more people that have been affected by it personally.
Did you get a lot of people passing by who had a positive response to you, that they honked their horn or waved their hands?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, they did.
As a high school student, how do you escape the pressure that comes with wanting to be accepted by your peer group? How do you escape the pressure when it comes to somebody trying to pressure you into doing something that you know is not good for you?
For me to be able to deal with that pressure, you got to be able to know that you're not going to please everybody. They might say like, oh, you're lame or you're not cool as I thought you were. But I think at the end of the day, you're doing what you know is right. Even if you're, you know, called names and stuff like that. I think finding other things to do that can consume your time, whether it be reading or working out, exercising, or even just staying at home with your family, just going outside. I think that's important. Like I said before, just surrounding yourself with people you know that are trying to do the same thing or on the right path.
Anything else coming up? Are you going to do another sign waving or anything else for your project?
Well, at the sign waving, I met some HPD, and they want to take me on a DUI like ride along so I can kind of see how it is in real life. So I think that's another opportunity for me to be out there. So try to get that scheduled and do that as well.
Well, Jonah Fuentes, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
That was Kapolei High School senior Jonah Fuentes talking with HBR's Russell Subiono. They were discussing the efforts to raise awareness of the dangers of driving under the influence in his community.